for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Yesterday, the Environmental Protection Agency officially ruled that carbon dioxide is a dangerous pollutant, a decision that allows the agency to begin regulating emissions. Joining me to talk about what this decision could mean for the nation's economy, climate change legislation in Congress, and for U.S. negotiators at the U.N. Climate Change Conference underway in Copenhagen, Jeff Homestead. He's former assistant administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency. Margaret Chris Hobson. She's energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. And Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. This is an issue that many people are talking about these days. I hope you'll join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. If you like, join us through Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Margaret, I wonder if you can tell us exactly what this endangerment decision says and what it could mean.
It was a decision that was made not unexpectedly by the Obama administration. They had proposed it earlier. Basically, what it says is that carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gas emissions, emissions that are causing the Earth to warm, are actually endangering human health and the environment, so the environment around us for animals and, you know, plants and the rest. So this is the first step in what could be several steps in regulating carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases over the course of the next year or two.
What is required as a result of this decision?
This decision does nothing to actually regulate, but it sets the stage for regulations, particularly immediately on cars, because that was something that was part of a Supreme Court decision, but it was the first thing on their agenda to start regulating cars, and to they've proposed regulations in that realm already.
Jeffrey Homestead, you've said this decision is entirely symbolic. Tell us why you feel that way.
Well, really, for the reasons that Margie just mentioned, it doesn't actually require anyone to do anything. But it is a step that EPA has to take before it can move forward with regulations.
Does it not set in motion, however, a certain series of steps that must be taken as a result of the decision?
Well, yes and no. Every time EPA regulates a new pollutant, they have to make an endangerment finding for that pollutant. In the past, every time they've done that, they do it along with the regulations. And so every time they decide a new pollutant needs to be regulated, they propose regulatory standards, requirements, and then as part of that, they finalize the endangerment finding. This is the first time we've had this standalone finding, and there's no deadline as to how quickly EPA has to act. Everyone believes, and I certainly believe, that they will act and that they will come out next year with regulations that are designed to control CO2 from cars and trucks, but interestingly won't have any real impact on cars and trucks because they are also being regulated by the Department of Transportation. So in this funny world in which we live, the regulation for cars and trucks is really designed solely to allow EPA to apply a permitting program to major stationary sources, power plants, factories, and other things.
Eileen Clausen, no major impact on cars and trucks?
Well, I mean, it's part of a package that was negotiated between the automobile industry and the administration to up the standards for cars and trucks. So in itself, Jeff is right. It doesn't actually do anything, but that's because this was already negotiated and the Department of Transportation is also moving ahead.
You know, it's interesting that the Wall Street Journal headlines EPA's carbon proposal riles industries. What industries then are we talking about, Margie?
Well, it's not the cars and truck industry because they've already negotiated an agreement for how they would go forward in cutting their emissions over the long term. It's more the industries that fear as EPA goes forward, they will also regulate them as well. Now, everyone knows they're going to be regulating power plants, coal-fired power plants, and many of the large industries. That's not unexpected. But there's a fear that this could go down to smaller-level companies and affect a whole lot more Americans. EPA says that they will find ways to get around that.
Can you explain to us what the research shows about why CO2 carbon dioxide in particular is a health hazard?
Well, Eileen might be better at that sort of thing, but basically what they're saying is that it's accumulating in the atmosphere over time and not dissipating, in other words, not spreading out, not going away over time, and staying there for a long period of time and warming the climate and changing everything.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think there is a great deal of evidence to show that the Earth is warming and that it is primarily human-induced. And how is it human-induced? By emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. So I think EPA's finding that this is a danger to public health and the environment is absolutely expected. And in fact, I don't think they could have done anything else unless they wished to totally disregard all the science.
It's also, is it not, talking, as you said, about human health, not just the warming of the environment.
Absolutely. I mean, I think humans respond to warmer temperatures. Agriculture changes because of warmer temperatures. Glaciers melt, and so communities that relied on water from glaciers will no longer have a source of water. So, yes, both directly and indirectly, it affects humans.
Eileen Clausen, she's president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies for the Global Environment. Margaret Criz Hobson, energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. And Jeff Homestead, he's an attorney in private practice, former assistant administrator for air and radiation at the Environmental Protection Agency. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. How does the Clean Air Act come in here, Jeff Homestead? Is it the best way to initiate these kinds of regulations?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. This is one thing on which I think industry and politicians and agency officials and environmental activists all agree the Clean Air Act isn't the best way to deal with it. The Clean Air Act was never designed to deal with this sort of a problem. It's a collection of many, many different programs designed to deal with specific environmental issues, and none of those is anything like climate change. On the other hand, actually, back when I was at EPA, we took that position. We said, this is an issue that Congress really needs to decide. The Clean Air Act was not designed to deal with this. And the Supreme Court overruled that and said, well, if you just look at the words of the Clean Air Act, it can be used. And until Congress does something else, EPA needs to consider using the Clean Air Act. So we're in this position now where virtually everyone agrees the Clean Air Act isn't a very good way to deal with this problem. But because there is not yet agreement in Congress as to how to deal with it, that's what EPA is left to do.
So is that why EPA took this action now, Eileen, because the Congress has not yet acted?
Well, I think if Congress had acted, they would not move forward with regulation. But as you know, the House did pass a bill. It will be considered in the Senate, I think, this coming spring. It's a real challenge. And in the meantime, I think EPA had no choice but to do the endangerment finding, to move ahead with autos, and probably to move into regulating stationary sources.
Does that mean, Margie, that we could expect lawsuits on this?
We've already had some challenges, verbal challenges on this. Some of the people who, the interest groups on the right, so to speak, those people that don't like government regulations are already telling EPA that they're going to challenge them. We've had some people from the left that are saying EPA is proposing to not go far enough. In other words, they only want, EPA saying it only wants to regulate large polluters, and there are some interest groups, environmental groups that are more liberal or more anxious for regulation that are saying, no, they should be doing more. And in fact, there should be a limit on how much pollution is allowed to be out there.
Jeff.
Well, Margie has really gone out on a limb by saying that there may be lawsuits.
No, there's guaranteed.
It's interesting, and I think all of us here have observed this fact, even if virtually all of the environmental community and industry agree that something is a sensible path, all it takes is one unhappy interest group, and whether that's on the left or on the right, to bring a lawsuit. And there's been evidence that that's likely to happen here fairly soon. So
Jeff,
it's going to be quite messy
Holmstead,
for a while.
He's a former administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency. And we'll take a short break. When we come back, more discussion and your calls. And as we talk about the announcement yesterday by the EPA regarding the emission of carbon dioxide and calling it an endangerment, we're joined now by phone from Dallas by Jeffrey Ball. He's environment editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Nice to be with you.
In your front page article for yesterday's Wall Street Journal, you quoted the Chamber of Commerce President Thomas Donahue, who said the EPA's finding could result in a top-down command and control regime that will choke growth. So to what extent do you think that statement represents the sentiment of a broad range of the U.S. business community?
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think it's worth probably peeling back for a second and talking about this issue in the context of economics as opposed to just domestic politics. What's clear is that the U.S. business community would prefer that that a constraint on CO2 emissions comes from Congress rather than from the EPA.
Why?
For a couple of reasons, boiling down to the fact that business thinks that it's going to get a softer, better deal from Congress than it is from the EPA. For one thing, I think it's clear that business thinks it's going to be better able to lobby Congress than it is to sway the EPA to shape the details of this in a way that's less onerous to business. And that focuses on two things. One is that particularly the power industry feels particularly in the sights here because power plants are such large single sources of CO2 emissions. And one of the things that's high on the agenda of the power industry, which has been particularly involved in lobbying on a move toward greenhouse gas constraints, is the notion that whatever the federal government does be economy-wide in the lingo. That is, that it not focus on a single industry, but that it focus on a number of industries, essentially, to lessen the economic pain on any one of those industries. And there's a sense that the Congress is better equipped than the EPA to ensure that anything that happens is economy-wide. Number two, we've not talked yet about the notion of a cap-and-trade program, but I know that you have extensively on your program in the past, and the notion here is that the government would set a limit on emissions, and then it would print up essentially a number of pollution permits, and it would apportion those permits to different industries and then specifically to different companies who could buy and sell those permits if a particular factory found that it was more expensive for the factory itself to install new machinery to reduce its CO2 emissions, that factory could comply with the regulation instead by going out on a market that would be created and buying permits from someone else who had determined that they could adjust their factory more cheaply. And the sense in industry is that Congress will ensure that there will be a cap and trade program, a trading program, where the EPA won't, and there's some legal question as to whether the EPA could come up with actually a trading program for greenhouse gases. And if the EPA does not come up with a trading program, business says that could be much more expensive than the flexibility of a trading program, which is why you see a fascinating dynamic in industry, whereas a couple of years ago, industry largely was saying it didn't want any kind of greenhouse gas constraint at all. I think it's pretty clear that industry broadly now has internalized the notion that it's going to get hit with something, and it's now trying to scramble in Washington to guide this discussion so that it gets hit with something that's as acceptable to industry as possible.
Jeff, let me ask you a question about cap and trade. Something I've been very curious about: is there an overall cap to be set that would be reasonable, set by those in the scientific community as an overall cap that they would believe would be acceptable, an acceptable limit, and then the industries would trade and cap within that overall limit?
Well, it's another good question, and the bottom line is that it's not clear.
Yeah.
We and everyone tend to talk about this issue in sort of broad generalities of cap and trade.
Right.
Stop. And in fact, the notion of a cap and trade is a lot less important and a lot less telling in how this all comes out than the gritty details of how it materializes. And so those details include a number of things. One of them is what you just mentioned, which is the severity of the cap itself, which is to say the percentage by which the economy will be required to reduce its emissions over time. But that's really, and certainly what is clear now is that there's been quite a lot of wrangling on Capitol Hill about that question, and industry has succeeded in reducing the severity of that projected requirement below what many people had argued they would like to see scientifically. But that's really only one detail. There are other details. We talked from a moment ago about these permits to emit emit greenhouse gases. One detail that I think is just as important as the severity of the cap, but that is sort of so gritty that often it doesn't get discussed, is how the government would apportion these permits to pollute among industries, among regions of the country, among specific companies. And that's really where the fight's going on, because from the standpoint of a single company, it's relatively less important what the total cap is for the whole economy. It's much more important who gets stuck with how much of that bill. And by the way, one thing we probably should mention is that today is the second day as well of the Copenhagen Climate Conference.
Yes, of course.
And the dynamic in Copenhagen about an economic fight among regions of the world as opposed to regions of the U.S. and industries around the world and companies around the world, I think is precisely the same dynamic that we're seeing playing out within the U.S. in response to the EPA's announcement.
Jeffrey Ball, he's environment editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. His column, Power Shift, appears every other Friday. You know, what I keep hearing Jeff talking about is money and the economy. I haven't heard any comments about health and carbon dioxide, CO2, and how it could affect the entire dynamic of what happens to plants and humans on this earth. And I'm looking at you, Eileen Clausen.
Well, let me start by saying that the whole debate in the Congress, and I agree with Jeff, that the debate internationally is all about money and the economy. But one of the important parts of that is the cost of not doing anything to control this problem. There aren't very good numbers out there on what the actual costs might be if we don't act. But those estimates that there are and the anecdotal information that is available suggests that the cost of not acting are far greater than the cost of acting.
Such as?
Whether it's flooding, whether it's extreme weather, whether it's changes in agricultural patterns, whether it's availability of water for people and for plants and for animals. All of these things have a real cost associated with them. And if we do nothing to control this problem, I think the cost will be huge.
And on that very point, Jeff Ball, I want to ask you about the controversy over the email that critics allege demonstrated an effort to shut off scientific debate on climate change. To what extent is that likely to influence debate either in Copenhagen or here in the U.S. Congress?
Two things I would say. First, as a backdrop, it's been interesting to see the polling over the past 6 to 9 months on public attitudes toward, that is to say, the public's willingness to spend more money on energy with an eye toward environmental improvement, particularly climate. This is long before the emails were hacked and publicized. And what the polls show is a precipitous decline in public willingness to spend money, and that's pretty clearly tied to the recession. So long before there were these emails, there was a general sense that people were hunkering down and looking at what they regarded as pocketbook issues. And you know, one reality about climate is that it is a sort of inchoate, long-term issue in the minds of many people on Main Street. And therefore, it's tougher to mobilize people to want to spend money to fix this than it is, say, to mobilize people to want to fix smog or the kind of pollution that typically the Clean Air Act has addressed, which is the kind of pollution that hurts people's lungs. People can see and feel that. That's the backdrop. So then against that backdrop emerges these hacked emails, which indeed are causing a lot of discussion in Copenhagen and around the world. There are those who think that this is a significant blow to the science behind the link between human beings and greenhouse gas emissions. There are those who say that this addresses only one of sort of several legs in that stool. That debate is playing out, but it's been interesting to see even the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is essentially the kind of consensus representation of scientific opinion on this, has said, while reaffirming its view that there's a scientific link between humans and climate change, that it takes these emails seriously and is considering what to do about them. And essentially what these emails say is that there was an attempt by scientists at a climate research institute in the United Kingdom called the Climatic Research Institute at the University of East Anglia, one of a number of very well-respected and influential climate science research institutes around the world. A number of these scientists who over the years have put together a record of temperatures going back hundreds of years, a record which shows that there was a spike in the average global temperatures in recent decades. And that record is one of the pieces of evidence that has been used to demonstrate that that industrialization and therefore human activity is a main factor in climate change, that there were all sorts of questions about the legitimacy of their techniques and efforts by them to quiet scientific critics, keep those critics out of the scientific literature. And it remains to be seen to what degree this impugns the science. What's pretty clear, and one hears this from people across the ideological and global spectrum, is that there was unflattering behavior that went on by these scientists. And it doesn't comport well with the way scientists are expected to behave in an open way, if indeed the goal is simply to find sort of scientific truth with a capital T.
Jeffrey Ball of the Wall Street Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jeff Homestead, I'd be interested in your reaction to those emails and the impact they could have.
Well, I think it is not terribly significant to the process that's going on in the United States. The administration has made it clear that they don't believe that it really affects their findings. And in fact, I think it was interesting that about the same time there was all this controversy, they went ahead and made this formal endangerment finding, even though they didn't need to for a number of months.
Do you think that there was an attempt to counter the impact of those emails that perhaps sped up the announcement by the EPA?
I don't think so. I think they largely ignored the controversy over the emails. I think the plan all along was to set the stage for Copenhagen by having a big announcement that the U.S. could make to show that they were serious about climate change. So I'm not sure that I'm the right person to talk about the political importance or the scientific importance, but in terms of the regulations that are coming up, I think they're largely irrelevant.
Eileen Clausen.
I think that's right, and I also think that this is another way to start saying we don't need to do something about this problem because some scientists behaved in perhaps intemperate ways in their emails. But if you look at the peer-reviewed literature, I think it's very clear that there is a link between human activity and climate change, and there is absolutely no question that temperatures have been increasing. I mean, Jeff talked about that period where there was a decline in temperature. The head of the unit at East Anglia University actually had published something prior to these emails where he showed that there was a discrepancy between some of the data from the tree rings and some of what they were seeing on the ground. So quite honestly, I think it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot. It's worth investigating. Let's make sure that there was nothing that was suppressed and that there was nothing that was done that was trying to hide data. But I'm pretty sure that when all is said and done, this is not going to be something that causes people to move away from dealing with the climate issue.
Margaret.
I think that it's important that the scientists with the United Nations said they will take this seriously and look into it. The big question people have is whether that data that might have been suppressed or handled differently is included in the underpinnings of all the other decisions that have been made on climate or all the other studies that have come out. But it's very, very clear that there are lots of other data out there that is available, that is not at all tied to this, that shows that climate change is happening and that mankind is causing it to happen. I think that it will actually play a bigger role in the legislative debate, because those people on Capitol Hill who don't want legislation are already waving a big flag, a big red flag, saying, oh, look, there's been lies. And they're using this as a way to attack efforts to control greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, EPA saying, well, Congress, if you don't do it, we will.
Jeff Ball, how important do you think these emails are?
Well, I think ultimately the answer to that question is going to depend on the conclusion of a couple probes that are underway about what actually happened and the degree to which that impugns the science. And the scientists ultimately will make their determination. But I think it's important to remember that that again, long before these hacked emails emerged, there is a sort of trajectory here, a history here of a lot of discussion about how to deal with the issue of climate change, and not a lot of action. And I think that at the end of the day, that comes down to money, that comes down to economics, and there are very real economic questions here about who, apart from the broader sort of macroeconomic question about how much this will cost the entire economy, how that will be divided up. And that's really, I think, what's stymieing action in the U.S. and globally.
Jeff Boley, he's environment editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. When we return, it will be time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems, in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
How government programs to employ artists served the nation during the Great Depression and could offer a model for creating jobs today. Art and the New Deal, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we'll open the phones now in our discussion over climate change, over carbon emissions and whether carbon and its emission is an endangerment to the U.S. and the world. Let's go first to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
I appreciate your guests talking to the email, but I think the email gate, our climate gate, and there are two other things, though, that I think would be nice to comment on. If I Google greenhouse gases, I find out that water vapor is the most potent greenhouse gas, attributing to 72% of global warming. And we have no control over water vapor. The other thing is, if I'm as smart as a fifth grader, I know that the planet's been warming up for the last 20,000 years since the last ice age. And that's a process that started long before GM or Ford had anything to do with it.
Thanks for your call, Paul. Go ahead, Eileen.
You're absolutely right about water vapor and all of the greenhouse gases. But I think when you look at what has been happening in the last few decades, it's not something that can be explained by water vapor. I mean, there's been lots of science that's looked at what is the footprint, what are the normal greenhouse gases, water vapor, solar activity, all of these things. But in fact, none of them can explain what we've seen over the last decades, which is a real spike, which goes at exactly the same time that our greenhouse gases have been increasing. So it's not that there aren't other greenhouse gases, that there isn't a natural greenhouse gas effect, which actually is important for us, otherwise it would be really cold. It's that what we're talking about here is something that really is man-made emissions.
So when he talks about the fact that the climate has been warming for thousands of years, that we started with an ice age and here we are now, is this not a natural process, Margie?
It's a natural process, but it's a very, very slow process. And what we've seen in the last several decades is an acceleration of the warming process in a way that scientists cannot explain any other way. And they have definitely tied to our combustion of coal and oil and basically the fossil fuels that are spitting the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Jeff Homestead.
I think all of those things are correct, but there do continue to be scientific questions about a lot of these issues, about the relationship between CO2 emissions and its impact on water vapor. And one of the things that has kind of been under discussion recently is, at least it appears from some of the data, that temperatures on average have roughly stayed the same for the last decade or so. There hasn't been an increase as predicted by the climate modelers. And the suggestion
isn't a decade a fairly short period of time?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It is. Yeah. But the models themselves would suggest that there should continue to be, as greenhouse gases have continued to grow, a continued increase in average global temperatures.
Eileen.
Yeah, I just think it's very important to keep in mind the difference between the weather and the climate, because we're talking about decades-long trends, and those actually haven't changed at all.
All right, let's go now to Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Lois. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your staff for having me get through. I'm going to get into something very elemental. I didn't know about water vapor, and I live here by the water, but we've made a point of not cutting down trees like a lot of people so we can see our beautiful Grand Traverse Bay that one of our astronauts decided to move here by after he saw it from the up there in space. But the thing is, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, there must be others like me out there that, even though we listen to these programs and we try to educate ourselves, remember back in school that we breathe out as humans carbon dioxide in the trees and bushes and that greenery exchange it for us as oxygen, which is why I say don't cut down any trees unnecessarily. So it may sound facetious, but I thought I might represent people out there that were not strongly scientifically trained or that, because certainly we're not supposed to stop breathing.
Hardly, Eileen.
There's no question that trees and greenery absorb these greenhouse gases, this carbon dioxide, and When people cut down trees, that's a huge source of global emissions. Fossil fuel burning is one. Cutting down trees is the other. So your caller is exactly right. Trees and various kinds of plants are very important to the temperature.
All right. Here's an email from Belpre, Ohio. Grant says, I live in the Ohio River Valley, where quite a few coal-burning plants reside. We know what the emissions from these plants that are often not held accountable for their violations do the air immediately around them. And when these pollutions, pollution emissions travel to the northeast, doesn't cap and trade just give these plants more opportunity to continue to pollute, add to people's health complications, when they can just trade their ability to seriously pollute off to another industry? Jeff Bell.
Hi.
Jeff Ball.
No, that's fine. It's a fascinating question that the emailer asks. And I guess I would say two things. The first is that this gets at the fundamental difference between greenhouse gas emissions on the one hand and what people traditionally think of as pollution on the other hand. What people traditionally think of as pollution is the stuff that they can see and feel. Again, the stuff that makes the sky gray, smog, and the stuff that gets into their lungs and makes them cough and makes kids sick. And there is a long history in this country, including in the Midwest, where there's a concentration of coal-fired power plants, of taking serious steps to reduce that sort of pollution. And indeed, the whole notion of cap and trade originates in the U.S. with an effort to reduce emissions that cause something called acid rain in the Midwest. And however, that was a very limited, essentially regional, almost localized program compared to greenhouse gases, which are much broader. And the political and reality of all this is that, as the emailer demonstrates, this whole thing about greenhouse gases is a very kind of broad, difficult to visualize concept, because although one reads about glaciers melting and malaria moving to different latitudes and that sort of thing, it's essentially for most people something one reads about rather than something one sees and feels. And so this is again why it has been very difficult to for the proponents of action on this to muster the political will to do it, because people in parts of the country, like the emailer, realize that the industry that is producing electricity from coal is doing it at relatively low cost. And one potential result of the of legislation or regulation to constrain greenhouse gas emissions, depending on how it is written, to be sure, could be an increase in electricity rates. Now, that's not a new notion, and there is a lot of effort to write the legislation or regulation in such a way that it mitigates that. But it's a difficult proposition to face that.
Here is an email going back to a point that you wanted to raise, Eileen. It says, I find it very interesting that industry would like Congress to decide on environmental matters when it comes to tightening the rules, but let EPA do the ignoring or loosening. Who is looking out for the collective me, Eileen?
Well, I think that the issue here is that while EPA can regulate under existing law greenhouse gases, because this problem is fundamentally different than a lot of the other problems that are dealt with by EPA, it really is something that cries out for a different approach and one that can be done by the Congress. Now, hopefully, the Congress is looking out for not just the industries that will be regulated eventually by EPA under a new law, but also the consumers and the public.
I think that that's the key issue that a lot of people are worried about. Is this going to mean cleaner air for me, or is it simply going to be the lobbyists at work trying to save money for the various industries they're involved with? Margie.
In this case, we're talking about a long-term cap. In other words, everyone would have to come up with some cuts over time. And how you get there is what is being manipulated at this point as far as what Congress, or at least that's what industry is trying to do and saying, not me, get the other guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And so in this case, as a consequence, you've got more people regulating here, but down the road, they're all going to have to cut.
All right, to
Can
David.
I just throw one thing in here?
Hold on, Jeff. Let's first go to David in Avon, New York. Go ahead, David.
Morning.
I
want to go right to back in the 50s, in my preteens, being brought up on a farm. My parents and their friends used to laugh out loud about one day the government would be able to tax breathing. Now, I'm looking at the fact that these people are talking about carbon dioxide, and the lady from the Bay basically took the lot of my wind away, but let's go back to protecting the wetlands, which, look at the Everglades in Florida. Back in, as far as I know, Iceland didn't have ice caps 600 years ago, from what I understand in history. So this global warming thing is just a Mother Earth's way of doing her seasonal thing. And as far as the water vapor goes, you know, the sun evaporates water from the ocean, separating the salt, which become white, billowy clouds, which come inland and they release rain. And, of course, like you said about the great clouds, that's carbon monoxide. Big difference from carbon dioxide.
All right. Who wants to take on someone who is clearly a doubter as far as all this is concerned? Jeff Ball.
Well, I was actually going to address a point in the prior discussion just very quickly, which is that I think it's important to remember that whatever the U.S. does here is not going to have a huge effect on global greenhouse gas emissions in the absence of action by other countries, particularly countries in the developing world like China and India. And the real environmental significance of U.S. action is going to be in the geopolitical context of the degree to which it engenders action by other countries, given the expectation that the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions in future decades are going to come not from the U.S. and not from the rest of the developed world, but rather from countries like China and India.
Right. Eileen, directly to David's points.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to really get into this to understand the differences between different kinds of gases and what they do and don't do. I would just go back to the basic point. Of course, there are all kinds of sources, natural, what we could call natural sources of greenhouse gases, and they keep Earth's temperature livable for us and for everything. But what we've really been seeing is something that cannot be explained by these natural sources, whether it's the sun or whether it's water vapor. It can only be explained by the scientists as a result of human activities.
Eileen Clausen, the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Rick, who's in Columbia, Missouri. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I was about the email on that conference that I heard on NPR just the other day, the professor whose emails were hacked or stolen or whatever.
Yes, he was on this very program.
That's correct. He was saying that a lot had been deleted and words had been misconstrued and taken out of context to, you know, say what whoever did it wanted to say. So I'm just wondering why the emails are even a controversy when the author of them has kind of said, well, it's not a controversy.
I think it's a good question, Margie.
When you can take things out of context, you can read them on the floor of Congress and you can make them sound important and scary. And that's what's happening right now. And this is what will happen when you get into the Senate debate coming up in the spring. People will get out there who do not agree with these issues, that do not agree that climate change is happening, and they will use whatever ammunition they have. In this case, these guys, their emails, and if there's a nugget of truth to the fact that maybe some of the information was suppressed, that will be seized on.
So what legislation would you expect from the Congress in the coming months? How strong might it be? How watered down might it be? Let me start with you, Margie.
I think that the least thing that could possibly get passed would be something that would require power plants to use more renewable fuels and some efficiency standards. That's a piece of legislation that's already been through one of the committees in the Congress, in the Senate, and that I think that there's a universal agreement, at least enough agreement, that you could get the 60 votes. The most you could get is not as much as went through the House, which was more aggressive. It would be some kind of cap-and-trade program with limited amount of controls, because you have to get 60 votes in the Senate, and that means you have to please not only the, you know, environmentally inclined members, but also those people who are in the middle, whose constituents are very concerned about the economy right now.
And jobs. Go ahead, Jeff Homestead.
I wanted to come back to a point that Jeff made earlier, that this was somehow, people thought they would get a better deal from Congress as opposed to from EPA. I really don't agree with that. The problem with EPA's regulatory programs is that they don't work very well, either for reducing emissions of CO2 or for imposing constraints on businesses.
Somebody has got to do something rather than nothing. Are we going to see something rather than nothing that's going to be meaningful, Eileen?
I certainly hope so. I mean, there is a lot of activity in the Senate. There was a bill that came out of the Environment and Public Works Committee. There is a bipartisan group of senators, Senator Graham, Senator Lieberman, and Senator Kerry, who are trying to work out a compromise that they think can get 60 votes.
We'll have to see what happens. Eileen Clausen, she's at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. Jeffrey Ball is at the Wall Street Journal. Margaret Criz Hobson is at the National Journal. Jeff Homestead is former assistant administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones.